That was a little bit of Morning Sunset from bassist Linda Mahon O's 2008 debut album Entry. Linda Mahon O is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance podcast. If you're listening for the first time, welcome, and if you've been with us for a while, welcome back. The show is part of the OSIRIS Podcast Network, one of more than two dozen shows on a wide variety of subjects, from music to craft brewing to parenthood to comedy. Visit osirispod.com to check them all out, and if you want to support Burning Ambulance in particular, become a subscriber on Patreon. It's just $5 a month, and it gets you extended podcast episodes, otherwise unavailable interviews, and other exclusive content. So visit patreon.com/burningambulance to sign up for just $5 a month. Linda Mahon O grew up in Australia and moved to the U.S. a little over 10 years ago. In that time, she's risen to a position of real prominence on the current jazz scene. She's very much in demand as a band member. She plays on albums by Dave Douglas, Art Hirahara, and E.J. Strickland, among others. She's recorded 4 albums as a leader, with a 5th one on the way later this year. She's a member of Pat Metheny's current quartet. She teaches at the Manhattan School of Music and other places. And she's a member of the collective We Have Voice, which is working to achieve greater gender parity in jazz. In this interview, we talk about a lot of different projects, including some that she barely remembered playing on. We talk about the various things she's doing now, how she sees jazz changing at the moment, and where she sees it going in the future. It's a very interesting conversation, and one that I hope you'll enjoy. I'm going to play one more piece of music now. This is Footfall from her 2013 album Sun Pictures, so listen to that, and then you'll hear my conversation with Linda Mahon O. My understanding is that you started out on piano and then moved to like reeds, like clarinet and bassoon. So what drew you to bass? Was there a certain point at which you realized this was your voice?
Yeah. Well, when I was in high school, I was playing classical bassoon and classical piano quite seriously. But my uncle gave me an electric bass when I was 15, and at that time I was listening to all sorts of music with my sister and with various friends of mine in high school, and we started a garage rock band called E-Day Fix. E-Day spelled E-D-A-Y, and I think F-I-X, which was kind of a play on words on the Berlioz idea of E-Day Fix, of having a motif kind of developing throughout the music. And it was kind of one of those high school endeavors, and it was really fun. We played all sorts of covers, Metallica covers, Rage Against the Machine, and Red Hot Chili Peppers, that sort of thing. And as a lot of young high school musically educated kids end up doing. Mm-hmm. From there, it's kind of I started getting really into Flea from Chili Peppers and all sorts of bass players, and into Jaco Pastorius, and that kind of led me through Weather Report, and then Wayne Shorter to Miles Davis. And then when I went to college, I wanted to learn how to improvise, I wanted to learn how to play bass, and I was very inspired by Ray Brown, and the album Night Train was kind of what woke me up to the upright bass in particular. I'd never heard that huge round sound before, and just his facility and just the way he articulated himself in the instrument, it was just incredible. So then I kind of left electric bass alone for a while and kind of went all into upright bass, and and now it's kind of like a mixture of both. That's pretty much how it happened. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And once you started moving away from instruments that could, you know, lead to a classical career, were your parents still supportive of your musical ambitions, or, you know, did you have to like sort of sit down and have a talk with them?
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. I don't think it was an issue with the fact that it was classical or jazz. It's funny because my mom did say at one point when I was in high school, like, why do you want to play jazz? There's just too many boys. It was funny, like, her perception of that was that at the time she was like, there's just so many boys, there aren't that many girls there, why would you want to do that, you know? But I think overall it was just more the idea of music being a career, I think. I think they were fine with it being an educational path, you know, if I were to go into teaching and that sort of thing. But, you know, as many immigrant parents do, you know, you pack up all your stuff from your home country and you go and find a better place for your kids to get good education and to make a living, that sort of thing. And there may be struggles along the way. Like, it's quite baffling sometimes when you see your child wanting to pursue a more creative pathway that maybe doesn't reap those financial rewards, you know. Mm-hmm. So I can see that, you know, and it's a valid fear, and we definitely needed to have that talk. And I mean, in Australia we are lucky to have a system where generally tertiary education is affordable. Mm-hmm. You know, and we have a system called HECS, which allows people to owe back the money, and generally, the fees are a lot lower than you would find in the U.S., so it is a slightly different thing than if I was U.S.-born, I think. But, yeah, those are all kind of valid fears that I think parents have. And, I just had to take the leap and just go for it, and here I am.
Yeah. What kind of experiences did you have seeing live jazz in Australia? Did people come through from the U.S. and Europe and stuff like that? I mean, what was your first jazz show?
My first experience of playing jazz were kind of just in the school jazz band, but there were a lot of great musicians around town, and we had some regular jazz kind of nights. Monday night was jazz night at a place called the Hyde Park Hotel, which is no longer there, with the Perth Jazz Society. There's a Fremantle. Fremantle is a little town just south of Perth. So there's a community in Fremantle, and they would have Fremantle Jazz Festival and Sundays in Fremantle. So, you know, there were always gigs happening and shows to go see of local musicians, who a lot who had studied abroad, and some who had lived and studied in the US too. But we did get a lot of people passing through, not as many through Perth as, say, maybe Melbourne or Sydney, because mm-hmm. they're on the East Coast and maybe a lot more accessible. And Perth is kind of one of the most isolated major cities in the world, so it's not so, it's far to get to, you know. So a lot of people, although they might come to the Melbourne Jazz Festival, they may not make it to Perth. But we were lucky enough to have bands like the Mingus Big Band came, and Gary Bartz would make some trips, which was awesome, which was amazing. I remember Andy Milne coming. I remember Jim Snidero. Like, yeah, musicians would pass through for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't so often, but it was definitely there. And we have people coming from Melbourne and Sydney, established artists there who come and visit. So, yeah, that was pretty much the exposure.
Yeah, yeah. The first record I see your name on Discogs is by a Lithuanian saxophonist named Kęstutis Vaginis from 2008. What can you say about that record? How did you get that gig, and, you know, what are your memories of it?
I honestly can't really remember much. I know Kęstutis. I think we both went to Manhattan School. Perhaps he was a little after me. But, I can't really remember, besides the fact that he's a beautiful player and a beautiful person. I remember there's a tune called Cloudy. But I don't really remember much else. I remember it being really fun. But I'm not entirely sure.
Had much experience in a recording studio before that, or?
I don't know. I don't think that was the first ever jazz recording that I've done. I honestly can't remember. Was that 2008?
Yeah.
Eight? Yeah, no, I'd done recordings before then. Yeah, definitely wasn't the first. But I can't really remember too much.
Mm. That same year, you were part of a large ensemble on John Irabagon's album Outright. It was like 15 people or something like that. Like, there were three other bassists, and you were the only electric player. What? how did you get that call? And what were your thoughts on, you know, that music, or what did you take away from that experience?
Right. I mean, and again, that was quite a while ago. I'm not totally, I don't recall everything, but I remember it being a very incredible and crazy experience. And I think John, I kind of remember which track, but he just kind of recruited a whole bunch of us to freely improvise over this piece. And his idea was that it was crazy, it was huge, it was a big endeavor. I don't remember too much about it, but I remember it just being kind of this craziness of everyone just packed into the studio and just improvising together. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your first album, Entry, was self-released, but it's no longer available physically. It's just up on, like, Amazon MP3 and on iTunes, and it's not on your Bandcamp page. Are you ever planning on pressing more CDs or putting it back out that way or anything like that?
I actually do have more CDs. I think the issue was that CD Baby, I was selling them through CD Baby because it's self-released. And part of that includes the process of constantly sending CDs over for them, and then them emailing back and saying that they need more, but you can't you can't just email them your 1,000 CDs for them to sell them. You know, you have to send them whatever the demand is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think eventually it just became quite cumbersome, and I've moved twice in the last few years that it just became an ordeal. So that's why it just kind of became digital, but it's still there. I'm still hoping to kind of put it on Bandcamp. It was licensed for a second to Greenleaf with the package. I think it was some sort of a holiday package that they had of my previous album, Initial Here, and Entry. So, but I am planning to. Some people have contacted me privately, and I've arranged to have it sent to them. But I will. I am looking into getting these physical CDs out there because they are printed. I still have some copies. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you put that trio together? Did you know Ambrose and Obed from school, or what was, or from other gigs, or what was, you know, how did that group come together?
Yeah, there's definitely the Manhattan School connection, even though I wasn't at school while they were both at school. Ambrose and Obed were at school together, but at that time, Ambrose had just graduated or had graduated for a year or so, and we had lots of mutual friends, and we would sometimes play sessions on occasion, and Obed, we had done some sessions with mutual friends, but he also was taking lessons with John Riley, the drummer at the time at Manhattan School, and Obed was actually substituting for one lesson, and so we got to play duo, and so it was kind of a combination of those things and having mutual friends, and I knew I wanted to do a trumpet trio. It was just a really cool context to play in, and so I wrote these songs specifically for that configuration, and it was really fun.
Mm-hmm.
'Initial Here,' your second record, it was Dana Stevens and Rudy Royston and Fabian Almazan, who's now your husband, on piano.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a particular concept for that record? Were you writing for those musicians, or what was the story?
Yeah, definitely a combination of both. Yeah, I mean, the title is called Initial Here. It's kind of generally about identity and, you know, and the pieces that I composed were generally pretty open. They definitely weren't as through composed as say Entry, you know. There are kind of some intricate parts here and there, but generally they were pretty open, more vehicles kind of for these musicians, because I knew Fabian really well, and I knew Dana well, and I played a lot with Rudy at that time, and I just knew that they could be creative with what I gave them. So there's some kind of challenging rhythms here and there. There's the album opens with their piece Ultimate Persona, which kind of has a bit of a tricky form, but you know, all these players, they're pros, and they were able to navigate all those things and be really creative with it. Yeah. The piece that I had with duo with Jen Shu, that has all the overdubbed Arco bass, that was definitely written specifically for her, because I knew that she could sing in Mandarin and in English, and she's also just an incredible musician. She's she can kind of sing anything that you give her, and I was a big fan of hers, as I still am.
And just before that, you played on Fabian's album Personalities, which I haven't heard, but it looks like, from looking it up, it seems to be part trio material and part string quartet.
That's correct.
So you said you've worked with Rudy Royston a lot, and I've noticed that there's a lot of records where the two of you are paired up. I find him to be a really interesting drummer, because he's pretty aggressive, but he's also extremely sharp and precise. Does that match up well with your style as a bassist, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, what I love about Rudy is that he's such a dynamic drummer, and he's got such a great sound on the instrument, but he's got this way of kind of egging you on a little bit, which I really appreciate. But he's also got sensitivity and can really be supportive, you know, so that's always exciting to me, you know, having that balance, and it's something I always appreciate. It's like a freshness, a fresh outlook that each time there's always a freshness to it.
Could you see yourselves becoming a team that people seek out, like William Parker and Hamid Drake are sometimes, you know, stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I mean, he's one of my favorite drummers and favorite people, so yeah.
Your third record, Sun Pictures, was a session that kind of fell into your lap, right? There was like an opportunity, and then you just kind of... So did you have music prepared, or were you forced to kind of pull something together when the opportunity to record was presented to you?
Yeah, no, I had music prepared, and I had visions to record that particular group as well. I'd always wanted to record something with those musicians, Ted Poor, James Muller, Ben Wendell, and we had played before. It was definitely a group I was planning to record with anyway. It was just, the situation presented itself, and it was great to have a live two-track recording, and I'd written those tunes for that session for the most part, incorporating, you know, guitar and sax in particular, with specific parts for them in some cases.
Ted Poor is an interesting drummer too. Like I've mostly heard him with Jerome Saba, the saxophonist, and you know, he's in that band, and Ben Maunder was in the quartet as well, and I found their style sort of almost minimalist, but very energetic at the same time. I mean, what was your take on, you know, working with him?
Oh, I think Ted's incredible. He's got such a such a wide feel, you know, and definitely kind of a vibe of kind of anything can happen. But he's an incredible listener, you know. It's one of those things, I think, that playing with him, he's super musical, but at the same time, I feel that I'm always kind of I have to pay attention, you know, because you know, like I said, anything can happen, and it's beautiful the way his ideas kind of unfold. I was listening back to some of the tracks on Sun Pictures, because I've been teaching here in Montreal, and we listened to some of those tracks, and just some of the way his ideas unfold and then resolve in a certain way. It's just super interesting, and sometimes decisions that I wouldn't necessarily instinctively make, and that's why it's always, I always feel like I'm on my toes, which is great, you know, it's just exciting energy.
Mm-hmm. You've been working with Dave Douglas for quite a few years now in a big variety of groups. What do you like about working with him, creatively speaking, and what does he want from you in your mind?
Well, one thing that I'm always appreciative of is that there's definitely an amount of freedom when things kind of get open, especially within the rhythm section and instances where we can kind of go all in and see what happens, which I find really exciting and really fun to play in that context. I mean, he's an incredibly productive and energetic musician. He's always on the go. He's always got different projects and different outlooks, you know, different things that he's working on, you know, and I appreciate, you know, having those moments of we can kind of go all in and see what happens, and it's a beautiful thing, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The quintet that was on Be Still, Time Travel, and Brazen Heart, how did that band come together, and what did he say he was looking for in terms of sound and approach and stuff like that when that project was kind of assembling?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, that's probably something that you might want to ask Dave about, is how it generally came about. But at that point, Rudy and I had already recorded Initial Here, which was on Greenleaf. So we already had a relationship playing, and I had played some with Dave at that point in various groups. The album Orange Afternoons, and he had a T4-3 project with three trumpets, and I played a little bit with Matt, just kind of on and off, just in sessions, that sort of thing. And John and I had played in a few different contexts. So we all kind of knew each other. We all had a playing relationship kind of already established to some degree. He didn't really discuss too much about concepts or what he was looking for. It was kind of, this is the group and these are the tunes, let's play them, let's travel with them, let's have them evolve. And Aoife was a part of the project where he had incorporated a bunch of hymns that his favorite hymns that his mother really liked before she passed away. So it was a project kind of an homage to her in some way, and incorporating Aoife, and she's such a brilliant musician and beautiful vocalist, but incredible kind of element, you know, in the music, the way she's so expressive, but also just brings something else to the table when added to the quintet. So that was something really special.
Yeah. What are your memories of the, because the whole stand that you guys did at the Jazz Standard was just released on CD recently. It had been out digitally before that, but what are your memories of those shows, and have you gone back and listened to them at all or anything, you know?
My memories were that they were really fun, and it's always great to play that many nights in a row, the same music with the same people. It's such a luxury that, you know, we don't often get these days, you know. It was really fun. It was really exciting. They're all great musicians that I work well with. I honestly haven't listened back to that music, you know. I think I listened back to it shortly after it was recorded, but it's been a while, and I haven't actually listened to this set.
Yeah. It's interesting from my angle as a listener, because there aren't that many sets where you get to hear a band working in that kind of extended context. I mean, I have a set, you know, by Cecil Taylor that's like 10 mm-hmm. sets, and then there's the Miles Davis plugged Nickel Box set, which is like, you know, 8 shows over 3 nights or something like that. So, but there aren't that, you know, it's not something that gets recorded and released very often. So it's interesting to sort of hear a band evolve from night to night.
It's exciting. Like I said, it's a luxury that we don't often get, you know, these days. I think besides a few places like the Vanguard and the Jazz Standard, like there aren't too many places that you will play for a week, you know. I'll get to play for a week.
Yeah. You've done 3 albums now with Art Hirahara, and 1 album where you both were backing Sarah Manning from like 2010. What's the relationship between piano and bass for you? Like, what are you looking for from him, and what does he want from you, do you think?
I'd have to speculate, you know. I don't really know. I've never really asked Art necessarily what he needs or wants from me, because I feel like he's so open to my interpretation of things, and he kind of lets me do what I feel, you know, which I think in the context of his songs, it's kind of, you know, and in most situations it's that balance of reading the written material but interpreting it in a way that is interesting and still musical and supportive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like on the last album and maybe the last couple of albums, like it, he'll be totally cool with me kind of doubling the melody at times and hinting at certain things, and I think that that's something that he's open to and perhaps likes about what I do. It's not necessarily just playing a certain part and sticking to it at all times, you know, which I would appreciate too, you know, if certain people need that, then I get it, you know, but with that, it's kind of a sense of freedom with that kind of stuff. He's open to various ideas, yeah. Especially when it comes to piano trio, you know, I think he's open to some different interpretations and, you know, so that it's not, it's kind of an ebb and flow of things, voices that are in the foreground or in the background, you know. As far as piano goes for me, I mean, he's a fantastic player. I mean, his compositions are beautiful, but he's got such a beautiful touch, and it's, to me, it's very crisp and clear, you know. And the ideas he plays kind of carries along with that. There's a conviction and a crispness that I really appreciate. And it's also really supportive, you know, in times where, you know, if I'm soloing or improvising, and yeah, he's a really supportive player. And we've played in many contexts too, even outside of, you know, that, and just random New York style gigs, you know, in various places, standards, and yeah, he's a really well-rounded musician.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You've done a couple of records with George Culligan too, who's to my ear is a very different kind of pianist from Art. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on playing with him?
Yeah, I've always had an awesome time playing with George. I mean, again, he's one of those people that he doesn't really have much, give me much direction. It's just more of a trust of, let's see where things go, you know. He's very open. I mean, what I love about George is that, I mean, he's got such a terrific energy. I mean, he's not just a pianist, a trumpet player, and as well as a drummer, and, you know, various things. And he's always so curious and open about these instruments and the way they function. I think, it's always exciting playing with him. And the few contexts I've played with him, it's been recording with him in various situations, and we also did one gig at the Jazz Standard Trio with Jack DeJohnette, which was kind of one of my highlights ever, you know, to play with both of them, and to play with Jack DeJohnette, and they have such a strong relationship, George and Jack, and it was definitely one of those gigs where it was kind of it was just very fresh and exciting for me. It was kind of, it kind of felt all in and all encompassing, and in a way that I really appreciated, because sometimes when I'd never played with Jack before that instance, and it was almost like we didn't need to test the waters at all. It was just kind of all in, right on the downbeat, which I really appreciated, you know.
Mm-hmm. I could see it being almost overwhelming in a way to be between two guys who play as hard as they do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate it, because it's something exciting, and it's always a great invitation to kind of jump in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And George is so open-minded, and he's very honest too, you know, about various things, and it's always a great musical experience to hang and play with him.
most recent album, Walk Against Wind, the lineup was really interesting because most of it was saxophone and guitar, with piano only on three tracks and then the traditional Korean instruments on one. Mm. Kind of walk me through the writing process for that record. Was it just stacking up tunes until you had enough for an album, or was it like a fully formed idea, and were you writing for those players, you know, as we discussed with other records? You know, talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, okay. Well, I definitely wouldn't say it's about stacking different tunes. It, you know, I feel like most of those tunes were kind of written for that setting, were written for those musicians, and most of them are very short, general vehicles. If I were to show you some of the sheet music, or even talk through some of the forms, like you might find that they're generally just short vehicles, you know. And quite a few of them have kind of signifying themes. And I was talking with some of the students here about some of the ways that those pieces are constructed, and some of them kind of like sister songs related to various other ones, either throughout the album or some directly related to other albums that I've recorded. For example, the tune Yoda, Yoda's on Sun Pictures, but certain themes kind of carry on with some of these songs. Like Yoda from Sun Pictures is kind of the sister song related to Deeper Than Happy from Initial Here. Mm-hmm. And kind of carrying on in that kind of vein of general kind of major Lydian sounding chords, with lows and highs of ones and sevens outlining those chords, that kind of carries on through to Ikan Bilis, which is on Walk Against Wind. So there's kind of threading songs kind of between some of these albums, but also kind of within. So I'm thinking there's Ikan Bilis, there's Deep Sea Dances, which is a very short kind of open form that we basically improvise just over the melody until towards the end when the harmony kind of comes creeping in. And it's harmony that's kind of a bit more unexpected because we've been in this kind of almost monotonal thing for a while, with some splashes of color that are kind of outside that key center. Just kind of backtracking a little bit, you know, I mentioned some of these major kind of Lydian sounds with ones and sevens and highs and lows that you can see in Ikan Bilis, you can see that in Yoda, you can see that in Speech Impediment, which is on the same album, Walk Against Wind. So there are definitely threads that kind of connect each piece, and some that connected in a way that I kind of wanted them almost next to each other, and some that I kind of placed in different areas, you know, so of the album, if you were to listen to it as a whole. But yeah, there were definitely elements that kind of thread them through together. But, you know, that's all to say that a lot of this music was written specifically for that setting, for that group. And they're generally just vehicles where some of them kind of disintegrate into open sections that are just free for whatever to happen, and other ones are kind of specifically on a set form or a set section of the form.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So with what you're saying about, you know, ideas that kind of pop up in multiple compositions and things like that, like with four albums of your own music and then stuff that you've done for other people, do you feel like you've developed a language of your own at this point, compositionally and stylistically?
I hope so. I mean, I tend not to think too much about it because I feel like it's always a process, and things are constantly evolving and changing. So I wonder when will be that time when I think I've arrived at a place and And I, at this point, you know, it's just kind of a process to me, and there's just a general feeling when I feel that it's me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I won't necessarily identify by, you know, well, this is kind of my kind of tune because it has this and that, you know. But generally, if it's something that I feel genuinely, I am expressing is me, like I that's what I'm trying to get at, you know, which at the same time is evolving and changing. So I don't know. I hope I am, you know, but it's not something I think too much about right now. It's kind of more about the process. But I will say that, I mean, definitely on Walking Into Wind and in some of these, in the more recent music, that I've put a lot more of the responsibility with the writing on the bass. And you'll probably find that I double more of the melodies. I kind of cover more bases, so to speak, on these more recent songs than maybe in the past. And that's something that I kind of wanted to have. I wanted more responsibility in my part as opposed to just in the written sections of parts, just having the bass being serving just the bass role, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I feel like there's certain, you know, composers, like you can tell an Ornette tune in three notes, basically, you know, and so I'm wondering if you think that there are elements to your music that make it immediately identifiable, you know, maybe not to that extreme a degree, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely elements, like I feel like, you know, with the threads that I mentioned connecting some of these tunes, there are definitely shapes and things that I would identify as kind of something that I like to do, you know, some of these bass lines, these highs and lows, and some of these kind of puzzle-like elements with some of the songs. There's probably most definitely something that I'm working towards that's kind of maybe a bit more of my mark, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The packaging on Walk Against Wind, the biophilia thing, is how has that taken off? Like, what's the response been generally? Do you find that there are grumpy people who miss a physical CD, or, you know, or people who are excited by it? Like, what's the feedback that you have gotten?
Yeah, the feedback has been generally positive. You know, I think, like anything kind of new, there's always going to be some pushback. And, you know, I get it. You know, there's certain usually kind of older generation CD maybe aren't so technologically savvy either, who want a physical CD, and I understand that. I love CDs and I miss that aspect for sure. It's just the direction that we've chosen to go in, especially because we've wanted to tie in these discussions and these issues of plastic production and plastic usage and doing this volunteer work with cleanups and with various organizations. And Fabian just did this workshop with Al Gore about climate change, and so he's now able to do these presentations about climate change. And it was just one of those decisions that we just had to bite the bullet and say, hey, we're going to do this now, you know. And it was a lot of work, it was a lot of planning, it was FSC certified paper with vegetable based inks. It's actually more expensive to produce than just printing CDs, because you can print plastic CDs for very cheap, you know, print 1,000. But this takes like a special, we have a designer who works with us to, especially for this format. You know, we have a printing company that deals with these, and they're hand folded. And there are little codes in there that you can download these files as WAV files, FLAC files, sometimes up to 96K, depending on the album. So it's not like you're losing audio quality. You're still getting some tangible liner notes, if not more liner notes than you normally would get with a digipack, or, you know, even a booklet CD, you know. You're just missing that plastic disc inside, you know. And it wasn't necessarily like it's not really a comment on people who still enjoy CDs. It was just our choice to go in this route, you know. And we've generally had really good responses. We've had many artists who've been interested and who've been like, oh man, I've been trying to get at something like this for a long time, you know. And so people definitely had the idea before. It's just, you know, Fabian went ahead and designed it and patented it. So, yeah. So, but, you know, there'll always be people that prefer a physical CD. And I have had people come with the bifolio with a CD inside it that they've burnt because they need to listen to it in the car or something. And, you know, it's not like we're advocating for that either, but it's just people figure out what they need and what they want, you know.
Mm-hmm. And is the... What are the plans for the label for 2019? Like, what, you know, do you have releases lined up and stuff like that?
Yeah. Yep. So I have an album coming out. It's called Aventurine, and it's with my octet. It features Matt Mitchell on piano, Greg Ward on alto saxophone, Chess Smith on drums, and then on string quartet, Feng Chen Hui, Sarah Caswell, Jeremy Harmon on cello, and Benny von Kutzeit on viola. And I also have some vocalists from the vocal group Invenio, which is a group from Melbourne, Australia, led by a fantastic vocalist called Gian Slater, who's a staple on the Melbourne music scene and an incredible musician. So, yeah, they're all my compositions, my arrangements. There's three which are arrangements of other things, but yeah.
And when
what's
the approximate release date for that?
Approximate release date is end of May 2019.
Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw that Fabian group at I saw you at the Jazz Gallery with that group. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So it's that same group, and Fabian also has a record coming out. It's a trio album, but he does have the. A string quartet on one song, I think, or maybe two. But yeah, so we recorded that actually in December in New Orleans, myself and Henry Cole and Fabian Amazon, and they're all new tunes. And so that'll be exciting. And also, we have fantastic musician, Harvard graduate, Rajna Swaminathan. A Mridangam player, excellent composer, and her album is coming out as well. I can't quite remember what date it is, but 2019 has fantastic musicians such as Miles Okazaki, Stefan Klump, and more. I just can't remember off the top of my head.
Cool. So how long have you been playing with Pat Metheny, and how did you get that opportunity? Like, what's the intersection between your world and his, I guess?
Well, I think we started playing in end of 2015, 2016, around that time. I think that's roughly it. So we met at Detroit Jazz Festival. We actually met a couple of times. I think the first time Soundprints was on the same stage. Soundprints, the band with Dave Douglas and Joe Lovano, and Joey Barron and Lawrence Fields, and we were playing on the same stage in Detroit. I'd seen his set, and it was amazing. And I met him kind of backstage, and we kind of chatted briefly, and he was very nice. And then a couple of years later, we were at the same festival, and I was watching Rudresh Mahantapa's band, and Pat was just about to play after them with Gary Burton, and we briefly chatted, and he just said, oh, did you ever get my email? I was wondering if we could play, and I was like, yeah, for sure. And I gave my email, and I was really excited, and we played some duo, and then we played some trio with Antonio Sanchez, and we all had we both had musicians that we knew in common and played with in common, and then that was it. Then we we started rehearsing with this new band with Antonio and Guillaume Simcock from the UK. And then we started off with an Asian tour and then various other tours. And we've recorded an album. We recorded that in 2016. And it features some pretty incredible music. And I won't talk much further about it. I'm not sure how much I'm supposed to tell, but it's pretty epic and it was an incredible experience.
So that band is going to be, I mean, you just did a tour with that band, right?
We did several tours this past year in the fall, and you know, we've done several tours already, but the most recent one was in Japan, but that was kind of a different thing. It was a trio with just myself, Pat, and Guillaume Simcock, and it was kind of more more like that trio setting and some of the songs from Missouri Sky and with Charlie Hayden, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's slightly different, but yeah, we've toured quite a bit with Antonio, yeah, with the quartet.
Yeah, yeah. So this record that you've just made, it's coming out in like April with Jonathan Blake and Chris Potter. That was a trio that existed for a little while before the gig, right?
Yeah, before that recording, yeah. Uh-huh.
So, like, when did that group first come together? And do you remember when you first played with Jonathan and Chris, either, you know, like, separately? Like, how far back do you go with those guys?
Yeah. Well, with Jonathan, I think we had two nights at the gallery. I can't remember when exactly it was, but it was winter. So it was probably the winter before we recorded. Yeah, they're both incredible musicians that I have a lot of respect for. Chris, I've been listening to, you know, forever on his own albums, as well as with various other people, Dave Holland and, you know. Jonathan Blake, I can't remember the first time I played with him, but I played with him in quite a few contexts, including with Kenny Barron on various gigs, with Kenny Barron Trio, and I think in slightly augmented versions of that, and as well as with Dave Douglas and some other musicians. So we've played in a few different contexts. He's what can I say? I mean, he's such an incredible feel, and he has such a beautiful wide beat, but the snap to his playing, that's just it's great to play with. It's exciting to play with. Super malleable, but has such a strong vibe, you know. And Chris, he's out of this world, you know. Such an incredible musician, incredible ears. And so quick, it was a great experience. We all brought in some tunes of ours and just kind of briefly workshopped it, but it's a really fun process.
I feel like both of those guys are, I guess the way I would describe it is they're like deceptively heavy. Like Jonathan and Chris both seem like really heavy, aggressive players, but then there's a layer of subtlety and introspective, like, listening that pops up after a while. You start to notice that there's a lot more going on than just, you know, kind of coming right at you.
They're both incredibly sensitive players. I mean, they both have such huge sounds and their instruments, you know, but they're incredibly sensitive and great listeners, yeah.
So the...
Yeah, Chris... Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to mention that Chris played one concert with my band, and it was so interesting. We had two tenors. We had Ben Wendell and Chris Potter, both on this date in Marciac in France. I mean, they're two very different players, two very different sounds, and... he was super musical, and he played some bass clarinet as well, and he just kind of slotted right in. He's just one of these people that just get right down to it, playing tunes for the first time, you know, it sounds like it's definitely not the first time, you know.
You, as you said, you brought in a piece for Jonathan for the record. So was that something that you had on the shelf, or, you know, what made it the right choice for that group to you?
I wrote that especially for that group and for that purpose. I can't even remember the title of the piece right now. For me, it's that particular tune was something like a little mysterious, and Chris has such a rich, big sound, and the way I kind of wrote it was that the melody is kind of relatively simple, but it starts super low on the tenor, so it kind of starts with this kind of mysterious kind of pulse thing, but with rich low tenor, and that's kind of what I wanted with that tune. And then it has some other twists and turns, but it's relatively open. It's very simple, relatively open tune, but that's kind of what I was looking for, and they did such a great job with it. It's got this kind of mysterious, whispery, low element, you know, and then it kind of develops into this other thing, and everyone was super sensitive with it and really musical, and that's kind of what I was going for with the song, something sensitive, mysterious, and dark. Yeah.
Are you someone who writes a lot, or do you conceptualize a whole project and then start working on music for that concept and that project?
It kind of goes back and forth. I mean, I write a lot for sure. I mean, I think they kind of both go hand in hand, whether it be visualizing a project and writing a lot. But I tend to do it kind of in spurts, and depending on what else I'm kind of working on. But I tend to do it in spurts, and sometimes I'll have these kind of ideas on the back burner that kind of sit there, and then when the time is right, they kind of come forward and I find a way to piece it and things. So, it kind of comes in different ways. I mean, there are certain things that I had ideas for, and I would go into that route of having the full concept, and but then all of a sudden something happens and there's a left turn and a curveball that I feel is kind of out of my control to a certain degree, and I take it some other place, you know. And I think for me it's kind of like being open to the fact that sometimes your initial idea of things isn't necessarily going to stick, and that things are going to evolve, and you may have to go outside of that particular concept that you're working on or something. So, it kind of depends, but, you know, my writing comes in spurts. It definitely just doesn't happen all the time that I'm just constantly writing. I wish it were that case, but it's just, I would say ideas happen, you know, constantly, but certain things kind of come forward first and other things kind of sit back.
Yeah. So obviously you're teaching as well as, you know, touring and recording and playing gigs and stuff like that. So what do you tell your students about the state of jazz? Like, are you more optimistic now than you were, say, a few years ago? Because it seems like the audience is growing a little bit and getting a little bit younger. Is that your impression as well?
I don't really know, because it's like, I guess I don't really know the statistics or you know, I mean, I perceive certain things. I go and see shows and I see certain things. I don't know, it's hard to say. If you're talking in terms of career and sustainability and what they'll have access to in terms of work when they leave, I'm not sure. I mean, I what I always say to my students is that it's good to be optimistic but realistic, but if there's a, such a way, you know, of being kind of both, but most of all, it's like, I kind of think if you're resourceful, if you're self-aware, if you're resourceful, then you can find a way to be successful, you know. So, I mean, I don't think too much about, I mean, I don't really know if it's for sure that, yeah, there were more younger audiences. I think there are certain ways of getting music across that have made it just so much easier, and people are more exposed to certain things that they wouldn't necessarily be exposed to, which is a good thing, you know. But I think overall, I just try and encourage resourcefulness and self-awareness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what do you see as sort of, because you're involved with We Have Voice and other sort of things, you know, so what sort of generational shifts, rather, are you seeing within the scene, like internally? Do you feel like things are changing in perceptible ways?
Yes, yeah, for sure. I mean, I see more of a gender balance generally. Things are changing, and generally people are questioning themselves, like, what their biases are, their assumptions are, and I think that's a really good thing. People are starting to realize that, okay, for all this time there's been a preconception that, you know, maybe women can't play or something, and people are really starting to question and be aware of these things that are kind of so ingrained about, you know, what we hear when we see certain people play or see certain musicians, you know. So there are a lot of questions being asked, and I think it's a great thing. You know, people are starting to talk more and discuss these biases more and more, and instead of just kind of letting things be a certain way, and people are starting to talk about equality of opportunity I think it's a great thing.
Okay, that was my conversation with Linda Mahon Oh, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Thank you for listening, and please consider becoming a supporter on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance, and I hope you'll come back for the next episode. Osiris.